Hi, Grace.
Hey, Quinn.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I've been listening to Good For You by Olivia Rodrigo, like, all day.
Oh my God, I haven't heard it yet.
It's really good. It gives me, like, Avril Lavigne, but also every single era of Taylor Swift, but also, like, Lorde, but also, like, basically, like, all the pops people. It's all mashed together. It's really good. Olivia Rodrigo, we stan you. Also, she got to meet Taylor Swift, and so, honestly, what else is there left for her to do?
Wasn't she it just... Taylor and Harry Styles that she met?
Yeah, but she's obsessed with Taylor Swift.
Right.
She also left them all, like, letters on their tables anyways. Just, like, wow, Olivia. Yeah, her song is really, really good, and it's just, like, iconic, and beautiful. She has like a hold over our generation because TikTok is already starting to use it as a trend.
Oh yeah.
Also, that Backyardigans Castaway song, is that on your For You page?
No.
It's a trend. It literally was at number one on the like trending internet songs playlist on Spotify that they make. I don't know. It's just like in the background. Sometimes they sing it. Sometimes they learn the dance. It's like Castaways. We are castaways.
Oh my God, I heard that today.
No, everyone's talking about Backyardigans.
I heard
which
that
they should.
On my For You page today.
Yeah, I saw Backyardigans live in concert, so everyone should get on my level. It was for my cousin's birthday. I was like 3, but I did see them in concert, so yeah. Some people see Taylor Swift. Some people see like Ariana Grande. Some people see One Direction. I saw Backyardigans and Doodle Bops. So, mm-hmm.
Love that. I never saw anything like that.
Yeah, we did it that, and like it was for my 3rd birthday. We saw Doodle Bops, and for my cousin's, probably his 3rd birthday too. Yeah, because his birthday is like after mine. For his 3rd birthday, we saw Backyardigans because both of our siblings were babies. Gotta love it. Honestly, Backyardigans is pretty cool.
It is, actually.
They were really good. I also saw a fake concert that had One Direction and Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga and Rihanna and, oh my God, there is someone else too. There's another girl, I think. Maybe it's Taylor Swift. I don't think so. But it was a fake concert. They were all, like, impersonators. Yeah.
Yes.
Those are my only concerts I've ever been to. And you could get autographs from them after the concert. We didn't get one, but I went with my friends and we were 8. We were 8 years old and we all thought that the Rihanna one was the real one. Apparently, we were talking to our parents and we were like, "Mommy, everyone else is fake, but Rihanna is real. I think she's the real one." She was not. It was not the real Rihanna.
Really cute.
She was in Small Town Ontario performing. Literally, they didn't even try to make it look like they were the real people because Justin Bieber was also in One Direction.
Oh.
It's the same guy.
Love that.
Yeah. So, speaking of British people, that's my segue. Yeah. British people. Been listening to Prince Harry talk all morning. Now we're going to talk about British people. His ancestors, I guess, kind of. Yeah. Technically, I mean, Mary didn't have any kids, but it counts, guys. Yeah. So welcome to Not So Bloody Mary, the show where we talk about women in history with bad reputations. And today we are on our last part of Mary Tudor. R.I.P. Mary. That's what it says at the top of my document. Dang. So that's what it's called. It's probably not going to be called that, but yeah, that's what's happening. You didn't get the memo. She died at 42. So we're not really.
Yeah.
It's not that far away. Yeah. R.I.P. Honestly, something was up with the Tudors because none of them lived that long and none of them really had any kids.
Yeah.
I just like to say that. Yeah, I don't know. They're all kind of a bit of a mess, I think. I think it's called inbreeding, but also I think there was something else there. Don't know. But we left Mary, and she was about to get married to Philip. Yeah, ew, but, like, yay for her. because she's wanted to get married for, like, her whole life because, you know, she was engaged at, like, 3. So now she's finally getting married. Yay. They got married on July 25th, 1554. I don't know anything that happened on July 25th other than that date. I don't have anybody that was born then. So, yes, that sucks for you. But guess what? It's the feast day of St. James, who was the patron saint of Spain. So there you go. Maybe the Catholic people, that's a day for you. But I feel like, I don't know. St. James's feast day. Great for him. This marriage was intended to, you know, recast England and Europe to, like, make them seem more powerful and breed a new line of Catholic princes. Yay! Woo. Babies. And it was also the first wedding of a reigning English queen. So it was pretty important because, you know, also Elizabeth never got married. So, like, there was a long time until there was another one of those weddings. Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks a lot. Honestly, where would we be if she had gotten married? Who knows?
No, who knows? Honestly, who knows?
Who knows? It's a little confusing to me. Especially because, like, King James was the one who started exploring Canada. And he would never have been queen if she had had kids. I mean, king. Sorry, James. But yeah, Mary and Philip's wedding ceremony was, like, really fancy because, you know, they've got that money, honey. And also, they have to have an important wedding ceremony because they're, like, royalty. It's just how it works. Winchester Cathedral, I guess, is where they got married. Yay. And it was decorated with banners, standards, streamers, and tapestries all emblazoned with Spanish regalia. I feel like maybe we should have some British regalia there, my love. But I'm sure there was a lot, I'll bet. There was a raised wooden platform that was covered in carpets that reached from the main door of the church to the choir. And at its center, there was a dais in the shape of an octagon, which was where they would get married. The arrangements for the wedding were based on those of Mary's mother's marriage to Prince Arthur, which seems a little weird to me.
Just a tad.
I think the reason it's based on that is because, you know, Catherine was Spanish and Arthur was British. Well, English, it's not Britain then. But, like, so they're getting, it's like reunifying the countries. But why wouldn't you base it off of Mary's mother to her mother's marriage to her father?
No clue.
Like, that just seems a little weird to me, especially because Prince Arthur and Catherine of Aragon's marriage is a bit of a mess. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Did it happen? Did it not? Not the wedding had happened. The ceremony was traditional and performed in Latin by Bishop Gardiner, and he was assisted by 5 other bishops. I don't know why he needed 5 other people to help him, but I bet that's just, like, part of the ceremony whole thing. Yeah. I feel like there was multiple bishops at Harry and Meghan's wedding, but I don't remember. It was, like, 6 a.m. I was tired. Once the full party was there, Don Juan... Sorry. Why would we name Don Juan Figueroa? Don Juan Figueroa. That's Figueroa is his last name. I know I'm pronouncing it wrong. But his name is Don Juan, and he was the regent of Naples. And he gave Gardiner 2 pronouncements by which Charles V bestowed on his son the kingdom of Naples and the duchy of Milan. So then Gardiner was like, we all thought that the Queen's Majesty was going to marry just a prince, but now she's going to marry a king. I mean, I feel like Philip's ego needed that. So,
true.
Great for you, Philip. Very proud of you. Mary then pledged from henceforth to be compliant and obedient to her husband, as much in mind as in body, which was in direct contradiction to Gardiner's insistence that in the marriage contract, Philip needed to marry as a subject. So basically, they were like, Mary, maybe you shouldn't say that you're going to obey him in everything, since you're the queen. And she was like, no, not happening. No. Yeah. And whereas Mary endowed Philip with all her worldly goods, Philip merely gave Mary all his movable goods. Ha ha. Philip and Mary then walked hand in hand under a rich canopy that was carried by 6 knights. At the choir, a psalm was sung while the king and queen knelt before the altar. And then the King of Arms solemnly proclaimed to them king and queen, declaring their titles and style. This is how it goes. Okay, it's really long. Philip and Mary, by the grace of God, King and Queen of England, France, Naples, Jerusalem, and Ireland, defenders of the faith, princes of Spain and Sicily, Archdukes of Austria, Dukes of Milan, Burgundy and Brabant, Counts of Habsburg, Flanders, and Tyrol. That is their full title.
Dang.
Dang. That's yeah. Wild. Their joint style, like how they're going to be like referred to, it was difficult to agree on because the English council really didn't want Philip to be named before Mary, since, you know, she's the queen. Like they said, Philip and Mary, King and Queen of England. They wanted to be like Mary and Philip, Queen and King of England. Right. But Philip was like, no law, human or divine, no is going to let me be named second, especially as the treaties and acts of Parliament give me the title King of England. So, jeez. Yeah. He's being a bit of a douche canoe. Yeah. England was now part of a much larger European empire. Yay. Which, you know, isn't really what they wanted.
No.
The people didn't really want that. The evening ended with a blessing of the marriage bed. Yeah. And then Philip's gentleman wrote soon after, one of them said that the Bishop of Winchester blessed the bed and they remained alone. What happened that night, only they know. If they give us a son, our joy will be complete. They definitely slept together because Mary thought she was pregnant like 2 times. So she knows how getting pregnant works. I hope. Yeah, I hope. She's yeah. like 39. She's not 39. She's 38. That was my math skills.
When did she die again? 40?
42.
42.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we're almost there, you guys. It's really not great. They went on honeymoon for 10 days in Winchester, and then they began their journey back to London. They stopped en route at Windsor for Philip's installation as knight and co-sovereign of the Order of the Garter. So great job, Philip. The Earl of Arundel did it for Mary. He invested Philip with the robe, and Mary placed the collar around his neck. So now he's even more important. And he has more British titles, English titles. At 2 o'clock on Saturday, August 18th, Philip and Mary were met at Southwark by the Lord Mayor and Aldermen and crossed into the city by London Bridge. Yay, they're in London. Behind them followed the Lords of the Council, foreign ambassadors, and the nobility of England and Spain, all on horseback, 2 by 2, in order of rank. So, yeah. Imagine being at the very back. I feel like I'd be so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, hi, guys. I'm the worst. Like, I'm the least ranked here. I think I would probably cry. Yeah. But luckily, I'm a woman, so I feel like I might not have been there. Maybe.
Who knows, honestly?
Who knows? The Lord Mayor of London then knelt down before them and gave the Queen the mace, which was a symbol of power and authority in the city. Yeah. The king and queen remounted their horses, and with 2 swords of state up before them, they rode into the city. Yay. Some weeks before, Mary had issued a proclamation telling all of her subjects that they needed to be nice to the Spaniards without insulting them. The Londoners were feeling happy, so there was little ill feeling displayed towards the new king. They were excited she was married.
Yeah,
because sexism, but also they want a baby, too. Be an heir.
Mary, you know? Got married.
It bothers me so much when I have to say that. God. Philip was presented as an Englishman, so they're like, he's not a Spaniard. What are you talking about? Mary's own Spanish lineage was also ignored, which is really funny because I feel like she's like incredibly proud of it. And she was depicted as being wholly English. Their marriage was, they were like, oh my God, we're reconciling because they're both descended from the same dude. John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster. Their marriage had united the divided Lancaster in house. I would just like to say that through Catherine of Aragon, they're descended from the exact same branch of John of Gaunt's family tree. So, okay. But Henry VIII was also related to him. So, like, yeah.
Yeah.
The pageant highlighted the fact that Catherine of Aragon, Charles V, and Philip could all be traced back to Edward III through John of Gaunt, while Roman Catholicism, which for 20 years had been reviled as foreign and traitorous, was now shown as the true patriotic faith of England. Woohoo!
Yay!
Catholics. Mm. Nothing against you, Catholics. Y'all are chill.
Yeah.
I had to go to, like, 3 Catholic baptisms, and the only problem that I have is that it was just really long. It was so long. The first one, Cooper and I didn't know what to expect, and we were only, like, oh, God, 10 and 7. And at our church, it's, like, half an hour, and then the kids go to Sunday school for another half an hour. This one was, like, 3 hours long, and we had to stay there the whole time. There was no Sunday school. It was not fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. 2 weeks later, Philip wrote to his sister, who was the Princess Regent of Spain, and he told her that they visited London and he was received with universal signs of love and joy. But despite the welcoming pageantry, because there's like all these pageants and stuff, they're like, yay, Philip! Anti-Spanish feeling was never really far away. R.I.P. Renard, our good old friend Renard.
Renard?
God. Do you remember him? The Spanish ambassador, dude.
Like, not Renard, like Renard.
Renard, yeah, like a... I don't know who to compare him to. But yeah, he's the new Chapuis. We talked about him in our last episode, but if you didn't listen to that, because it was a mini-sode, Renard is the Spanish ambassador, and Mary's, like, obsessed with him. a little too obsessed. Not in, like, a romantic way, just that she needs to talk to her own English advisors. Yeah. But Renard told the emperor that the English loudly proclaimed that they are going to be enslaved because the queen is a Spanish woman at heart and thinks nothing of Englishmen, but only of Spanish and bishops. So the English people don't really like the Spanish people. He told Charles that it was going to be difficult to reconcile the Spaniards with Englishmen because the language was an obstacle and the English hated foreigners and the slightest altercation might be enough to bring about a very dangerous situation. I think that the English need to chill their pants a little bit.
Yeah.
But also, like, I understand being afraid that Philip is going to make Mary make England part of Spain, because they already know that she's, like, obsessed with Spain.
Yeah.
And also, she's a woman, and it's 1554. Just... Sure. Same. Philip had intended to only stay in England for a short time, although Mary was probably unaware of this. On the eve of his arrival in England, the French had defeated imperial forces at Marienburg, which was the gateway to the Netherlands. Brussels had looked vulnerable to the French, and Philip had brought 4,000 troops to go on to the Netherlands. Charles instructed Philip to take only a few of his servants ashore with him in England, and immediately after the marriage, and having spent just 6 or 8 days with his bride, to sail straight to Flanders. But then the military situation improved, and so the emperor was like, yeah, you can stay a little longer, Philip. Okay. Good? Good. On Sunday, November 25th, Spanish courtiers staged a cane play, Lego de Canis, which was a joust in where instead of lances, there was canes. I don't know what... I'm going to assume these canes are, like... different from canes now.
Yeah.
Can you imagine just, like, watching people, like, running each other with, like, old people canes? They did it for the queen and the English noblemen at Whitehall. The king rode in red and everyone else rode in yellow, green, white, or blue, and they had targets and canes in their hands, and they hurled rods at one another, and the trumpets were in the same colors, and there was drums and banners, too. It was a really, like, great display of color and sporting prowess. Good job. But it really didn't do anything to win over the English hearts. They still didn't like them. Rip. But months later, this cane play has actually, it's come to light that the cane play was the occasion of a treasonous conspiracy.
Dang.
Yeah. A man named Edward Luckner alleged that he had arranged with Sir Francis Verney and Captain Edward Turner to kill Philip and his Spanish attendants during the contest. He claimed that more than 300 people had been involved in the plot, which was supposed to be carried out in the third round of the tournament, but only 2 rounds happened, so therefore the plan could not be executed. Yeah, seems a bit crazy, you guys. But, you know, yeah. Philip's good. He can deal with this treasonous stuff. He's okay. He quickly becomes he starts becoming a king. I mean, he was, but now they start to, like, change everything to have him on it. So there's a lot of money that they spend on embroidered cloths of estate, badges, and heraldic devices decorated with both the king and queen's initials, just like all the ha 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 when Henry and Anne got married. There's still literally like an H&A thing from them on like the palace, it's like ceiling, like Hampton Court or something. It's, I don't know.
Cool to think about though.
It's been 400 years. Why did no one take it down? Like, why did Mary take it down?
It's, I don't know. It's just like really cool to know that they did that.
I really want to go there, but I'm just really confused that Mary didn't take it down or have it replaced with a C or a K.
Yeah.
She would do that.
She would.
She would. But she didn't, so everyone go to that place. I'm literally gonna go there one day and just like stare. But in September 1554, new coins were issued, and both Philip and Mary were on them, in the double face. So you know how, like, on our coins, we have, like, the heads and tails?
Yeah.
They had two head sides, so, like,
different heads.
On one side, there's Philip's head, and on the other side, there's Mary's head. But this is the problem. Philip's head goes on the left-hand side, which is the position that before that was always for the reigning monarch.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's, like, one crown above both their heads, but, like, yeah, he's on the reigning monarch side. So one pamphleteer complained that Philip was being turned into a king of England indeed. His name was appearing on proclamations and on charters and on coined money going abroad. So they were mad about that. The Spaniards' view of the marriage was quite different from the English. It sounds sexist. They believed that Philip would provide the male element lacking in Mary's monarchy. He would, quote, make up for other matters which are impertinent to women, end quote.
Oh,
gross.
My.
Gross.
Okay, I'm like, sorry, I keep, when you say Prince, or sorry, like, Philip, I keep thinking of, like,
dead Prince Philip that just died?
Yeah.
Like, Queenie's husband?
Yes.
Okay, well, he had a lot of other problems, but he never said that. Yeah, I'm sorry, Prince Philip, Windsor man. God, Mountbatten. Mountbatten is his last name. I watched The Crown, guys. I'm really smart. But sorry, Prince Philip. Grace is not actually mad at you at this moment.
It's fine.
Yeah. Well, this Prince Philip is almost immediately obsessed with reconciling with Rome. He petitioned the Pope to get Cardinal Pole more power so that he could negotiate for a general settlement with regard to church property. Finally, the Pope was persuaded. England's imminent return to Catholicism was a tremendous coup for the Habsburgs. They're like, yes, this is great. I can't do a Spanish accent, so I'm not going to try. I could do an Italian one, but that's different. So, since he had been appointed as papal legate on August 5th, 1553, Cardinal Pole had been petitioning Mary to allow him to return to England. He had traveled as far as Brussels, but had prevented from going any farther as the emperor wanted to secure Philip's marriage to Mary before England started, you know, becoming Catholic again.
Yeah.
In many ways, Pole and Mary were kindred spirits. I actually can't ever hear those words without thinking of Ella and Brianna singing that song in our Anne of Green Gables, the musical.
Same.
They practiced it for so long. Don't you remember the dance rehearsal that we were all, like, waiting and they were still doing it because they were getting one thing wrong or something?
You didn't even hear Ella at home.
Oh, my God.
Singing it constantly.
It was a bit of a mess. She was, like, always singing it. Ella, if you're listening, you sounded really good, but, like...
We love you.
You were always singing it. It was just because she wanted to make sure she sounded good, and she did, so it worked.
Yeah,
so... But Paul and Mary are, like, the same. They're not, actually, but they're pretty similar. Both of them had suffered for their faith and lived 3 years of isolation and fear of death. Paul had been in exile for most of his life. Both of them had lost their mothers to Henry VIII's cruelty, because, you know, Reginald's mom is Margaret Pole, who we did half of a mini-cast on. But England had changed in Reginald's 20-year-long exile. Years of anti-papal propaganda had left many English people hostile to the idea of a return of papal authority. Let's think about it. Henry VIII broke from Rome in, like, he became supreme head of the Church of England in 1532, but he, like, officially broke from Rome in, like, 1534 or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's been 20 years. Most of the people, like, obviously, if you're, like, 10, right, if you were 10 when it happened, you're 30 now. And life expectancy was not that long then. So... I feel like the majority of the people have just been like, that's what they've grown up with, and the rest of them didn't really, they're kind of done with it now. There's a whole generation that had grown up knowing only the king as the head of the church, because Elizabeth is, you know, kind of that generation. She never knew anything different because it was created for her.
Yeah.
Imagine having a whole church created just so you could be born. But you know, what wasn't enough for her, well, for Henry, they literally like got married so that she wouldn't be a bastard. So good job, Elizabeth, way to do that. Yeah, fetus Elizabeth created a whole church. Also, a lot of the church lands had been given to people and they didn't want to give them up. They're like, I got this land. It's mine. I'm not giving it back.
Yeah.
No. Finally, though, with the Spanish marriage concluded and a compromise kind of reached, Parliament repealed Pole's attainder for treason, and he could finally come back to England. He hasn't been allowed to come because he, you know, got attainted for treason. So.
Yeah.
Don't know if you want him in charge of your... Like, literally, that's like a criminal record, but... He didn't really do. I mean, I think he actually did do wrong things, but whatever. On November 20th, around 15 months after he'd been appointed as legate, Pole landed at Dover. 2 days later, he journeyed to London, accompanied by a bunch of English noblemen and counselors. Yeah, so he, like, arrived at Whitehall at noon, and he was met on a landing stage by Philip. Okay. With the sword of state before them, the king and cardinal proceeded to the presence chamber where Mary awaited them. Pole hadn't seen her since she was, like, a princess and also young. And then they, like, cried because they were really happy to see each other. Aww. Which is nice because he's the son of her governess that she, like, loved like a second mother. So.
Yeah.
Yay. At 5 in the afternoon on St. Andrew's Day, which is November 30th, Pole was conducted in full pontifical robes from Lambeth Palace to Westminster. There, with the Lords and Commons and the King and Queen kneeling before him in their robes of estate, he formally absolved the country from its years of schism. I think that means heresy. I believe. Right. I don't know a lot of church terms. I don't listen when I go there, and I haven't been there in 2 years. According to John Elder, it moved a great number of the audience to change their cheer and be like, yay, because they were crying before. And then they're happy. England had returned to the Catholic fold. It was a moment of high ceremony and emotion. Good and bad emotion. The Sunday after the reconciliation with Rome, which was the first day of Advent, literally the best time of church. That's Christmas season. Mary, Philip, and Pole attended a high mass sung by the Bishop of London at St. Paul's Cathedral. The crowds were, like, really big. And they kept begging the cardinal for his blessing. After Mass, Bishop Gardiner preached at St. Paul's Cross, okay, and he based his sermon on the Book of Romans. I don't know what the Book of Romans is. I'd ask Ella, but she's not here. I think it's one of the old books since it says Romans, but I don't know. Upon his arrival at Whitehall on November 24th, Cardinal Pole had addressed Mary with opening words of the Ave Maria. Hail, thou art highly favored, the Lord is with thee, blessed art thou among women. The words by which the angel Gabriel had heralded the Virgin Mary's conception of Jesus. I didn't know that, but okay. Pole's greeting was, it seemed, equally prophetic. Shortly after he left, Mary sent a messenger after him. She had felt her child stir when Pole greeted her. She knew she was pregnant. Okay. The pregnancy was now seemingly confirmed, and so letters were sent from the council to bishops ordering, oh God, We have this word all the time, and I can never say it. Te-duums, the nice prayer song things. And special prayers offered for this good hope of certain succession and to give thanks for her quickening with child and to pray. The news was proclaimed across Europe. This is just giving me secondhand embarrassment and also sadness. It was a sentiment shared by many. Everyone's really happy. As long as Mary was childless, there was anxiety in the kingdom. Because, you know, if she died, then who knows what's going to happen. It'd be Elizabeth. But the future of the Catholic Restoration would depend on the fruitfulness of the marriage. So everyone who's Catholic and wants to stay Catholic is like, oh, God, please be pregnant. They don't want Elizabeth. Well, everyone starts to want her way more after some things that Mary does in a year or so. So really great for Elizabeth's PR, but not great for Mary's. No. Just really not good. Mary was expected to give birth on or before May 9th. I don't know where they got this date. It seems specific. Like, I could imagine if they're, like, the beginning of May, but they're like, no, May 9th.
Yeah.
It will be May 9th. Exactly. The chamber and the nursery were made ready. The chief gentlewomen of the kingdom were summoned to witness the birth. Wet nurses and rockers were put on standby, and the royal cradle was prepared. And a Latin verse and English translation were put in it. It says, well, it said, the child which thou to Mary, O Lord of might, hast sent to England's joy in health, preserve, keep, and defend. It rhymed.
Look at that.
Look at that. A series of letters announcing the baby's safe arrival were prepared, and they were signed by Mary herself, ready to be sent to the Pope, the Emperor, the King of France, the Doge of Venice, and the Queen Regent of Flanders. In most of them, the sex of the child and the date of delivery were left blank to be filled in by clerks at the last minute. I see they've learned from Henry's mistake with Elizabeth, but the letter to the Pope specifically informed His Holiness of the happy delivery of a prince. I hope they left room for an SS to be added. Just a throwback to 1533 when Henry was like, we are very excited for you to meet our prince, period. And then they'd be like, oh God, put in those two S's real quick, guys. Because of the dangers of childbirth, provision was made in the event of Mary's death for Philip to be made guardian of the realm during the minority of the expected child. I would just like to say that that would be like a lot of years. He would still be confined within the limits of the marriage treaty, and he couldn't call parliament, declare war, or arrange for a marriage for the heir without the consent of a council of 18 peers. And that seems okay, but I feel like he wouldn't have kept it, so.
Yeah, probably.
Finally, at the beginning of April, the king and queen moved to Hampton Court in advance of Mary's confinement. Mary preferred Windsor, but it was considered too far from London for her to be secure. At Hampton Court, she would have the protection of her full guard and have closer access to the troops from the city and the arsenal at the Tower. But guess what? If Mary and Elizabeth cannot let anything rest without being dramatic to each other. While Mary prepared for the birth, Elizabeth was summoned to court from Woodstock because they had to be like, ha, guess what? Heir.
Yeah.
Here's the new heir. Yeah, it was supposed to be like nice, but I'm pretty sure it was a little bit of a look what I've got. She arrived in late April, and she stayed in the Prince of Wales's lodging, which had been built for her brother Edward. That would be really uncomfortable for me to be in my dead brother's rooms, but okay. It's been a while since he died. It was more than 2 years since the sisters had seen each other because Elizabeth's been in house arrest. But after she arrived at court, she had to wait for 3 weeks before Mary would even see her. Okay. Then at 10 at night, Elizabeth received her summons. So Mary was like, no, you can't see me. And then literally in the middle of the night, she's like, come now. Okay. With the guards that had to hold torches, because it was dark outside, Elizabeth was escorted through the garden to the privy lodging and accompanied by Susan Clarencieux, Mary's favorite little lady-in-waiting, was brought into the queen's presence. Elizabeth knelt while Mary spoke over her, and she was, like, giving her crap for refusing to acknowledge her offense and Wyatt's rebellion. Okay. She told her that, you will not confess your offense, but it stands stoutly in your truth. I pray God it may so fall out. And Elizabeth said, if it doth not, I request neither favor nor pardon at your majesty's hands. I humbly beseech your majesty to have a good opinion of me, and to think me to be your true subject, not only from the beginning hitherto, but forever, as long as life lasteth. I don't know who was sitting there recording this, but apparently that's what they said. At daybreak on Tuesday, April 30th, bells rang out the news that Mary had safely delivered.
Yay!
Henry Machine? Machin? I don't know. It looks like Machine. Henry wrote in his diary, "The Queen's Grace was delivered of a prince, and so there was great ringing through London and divers places, and they sung those songs. Soon after midnight, with little pain and no danger, she had given birth to a son. The news was received with unadulterated joy. Everyone's really happy. All the shops were shut down. The people rushed to church to, you know, pray. Bonfires were lit and tables of food and wine were set up, and there were spontaneous street parties that erupted all over London." I want to be in a street party right now, but I can't be. "How fair and beautiful and great a prince it was, as the like had not been seen," one preacher said. Okay, have you seen the baby? No. What if it's like an ugly little baby? Sorry, babies, y'all are cute. They really aren't, though. When they're newborn, they're kind of not. Reports quickly spread to courts across Europe. Thomas Gresham, the English ambassador to the Netherlands, reported how news had reached Antwerp that the queen was brought to bed of a young prince on April 30th, and the city's great bell was rung in celebration. The English merchants fired their guns across the water, and the regent sent the English mariners 100 crowns with which to celebrate the news. By the evening of May 2nd, the imperial court was rejoicing out of measure to hear of the prince's birth. But then... the bells were soon silenced, and the bonfires were extinguished. The rumors were false. The queen had not gone into labor, and fresh calculations had to be made. Days passed, but the labor pains did not begin. Speculation continued to fill letters and ambassadorial dispatches. Ruy Gomez observed on May 22nd that he had seen the queen walking in her garden with such a light step that it seems to him that there was no hope at all for this month. Renard wrote, "Everything in this kingdom depends on the queen's safe deliverance. If she did not bear a child," he foresaw, "trouble on so great a scale that the pen can hardly set it down. The delay in the queen's deliverance encourages the heretics to slander and put about false rumors. Some say that she is not with child at all." Philip had already expressed his doubts. Writing in April to his brother-in-law, he declared, "The queen's pregnancy turns out to not have been as certain as we thought." Okay. "Your Highness and my sister manage better than the Queen and I do." Yeet. The summer turned increasingly trashy. The weather was so bad that someone said the like is not remembered in the memory of man for the last 50 years. Mary grew more and more reclusive. She would sit in one place for hours at a time, neither leaving her chamber nor giving audience to anyone. People now know that she was wrestling with depression and anxiety, but they were just like, she's sad. To those who saw her, she looked pale and ill, and she was weeping and praying that her labor pains would begin. Her prayer book actually still survives, and the pages are worn and stained around a page that has a prayer for the safe delivery of a woman with child, which is really sad.
Yeah.
That makes me really sad. As the weeks passed, the mood became one of despair. Some people said the queen was dead. She wasn't, guys. Don't worry.
FYI.
Every few days, there was new rumors about her that were being thrown into the streets. They stirred up fears and they encouraged rebellion. By June, the Earl of Pembroke and a number of troops had to be brought in to keep order in London. Protestant pamphleteers alleged that the king kept company with whores and commoners' daughters while Mary was confined to her rooms. Rumors circulated that Mary had never been pregnant at all, but that they were going to find a baby and just say it was hers. Or that the fetus had been only a pet monkey or a lap dog, or that the queen had delivered a mole or lump of flesh and was in great peril of death. She's not. The French ambassador thought that all the prayers and anticipation was dumb because he thought that the queen's pregnancy was just an elaborate farce. He had been informed by two of Mary's intimate female attendants, Susan Clarencius and one of the midwives, that the queen's state was not that great, and it was just some kind of woeful malady. For several times a day, she spent long hours sitting on her floor with her knees drawn up to the chin. I'd just like to say that no pregnant woman that is like 9 months pregnant would be able to sit with her knees touching her chin.
Yeah.
Unless you're really bendy. The midwife believed that the queen, though pale and peaked, was not pregnant. By the end of June, the doctors had given up trying to predict when the queen would deliver. On the 26th, Michielli wrote that everyone was like, yeah, we don't know what's going to happen. We're all just kind of praying. At the end of July, daily processions and prayers for the royal baby's delivery were halted. On August 3rd, with no public announcement and just simply on the pretext that Hampton Court needed to be cleaned, the court moved to the far smaller residence of Oatlands. I'm pretty sure Elizabeth lived there for a little bit, allowing for the large retinue of gentlewomen, rockers, and nursery staff to be dismissed. There had been no baby. Ugh. Like her mother 40 years before, Mary had been deluded into believing that she was pregnant. Michielli, after the event, so he's writing like later, he described how from her youth she had suffered from the retention of menstrual fluids. I guess that just means that like her belly swelled. And so she swelled up and her breasts enlarged and sent out milk, I guess, for some reason. It was this that had led to the empty rumor of her pregnancy. The same thing happened to Catherine of Aragon. So basically she like miscarried, but the doctors were like, no, you had twins. There's one twin that's still there.
Oh.
There was not a twin that was still there. Yeah. So that really sucked for them. Yeah. So now Philip is like, sorry, there's no prospect of an heir. I'm leaving. R.I.P. But I'm going to be honest, there was actually like a reason he was leaving. I didn't write it down, but I'm pretty sure that the research I had said that his mom had died, and so they were waiting to bury her until he got back. And he's like, no, I gotta wait for my baby, and then there's no baby. And so he's like, gotta go. He was afraid to tell Mary his intentions, so he rehearsed how he would tell her in a draft letter. So he like wrote a letter to like practice.
Oh my god.
I would also do that.
True, but like,
oh. And he probably sent it to Roy Gomez, and he said, let me know what line I am to take with the queen about leaving her and about religion. I see I must say something, but God help me. He decided to leave most of his household to try and convince the queen that he would return fast. But the Venetian ambassador reported that it was said more than ever that he would go to Spain and then just like continuously remove more and more of his household until no one was left. Imagine being like the last three people there. Yeah. Just still here. Philip would be leaving England with a Catholic restoration achieved and the enforcement of Catholic obedience underway. 6 months before, the medieval treason laws repealed by Edward VI, go Edward, had been restored. The secular authorities were empowered once again to deal with opponents. Any words and activities that were seditious, which is like heretic, would be punished. With the rising threat of disorder and rebellion, the restoration of Catholicism was to take on a ferocious edge. Heretics would be burned alive. On Monday, February 4th, 1555, John Rogers, the canon of St. Paul's, was led out to Smithfield, condemned as a heretic. Gray clouds lined the streets to watch the procession. Among them were his wife and his 11 children.
Oh.
I don't know why we bring the children to daddy's death, but okay. They were there. As he stood at the stake, he was offered a pardon on the condition that he recanted, which means that he was like, I was wrong, I'll be Catholic now. But he refused, just like Lady Jane Grey did. He exhorted the people to stand firm in the faith that he had taught them. When the fire took hold of his body, he washed his hands in the flame as he was burning. As Renard said, some of the onlookers wept, others prayed God to give him strength, perseverance, and patience to bear the pain and not to recant, and others gathered the ashes and bones and wrapped them up to preserve them. Yay. I'd just like to say that people get burned for heresy, not just in Mary's reign. Henry VIII was burning Protestants until, like, the last days of his reign. He also burned Catholics, though. He just was really confusing. He needed to, like, calm down. Roger's death was followed just days later by those of two country parsons, Lawrence Saunders, the rector of All Hallows in Coventry, and Dr. Rowland Taylor, the rector of Hadley, Suffolk, and by the former bishop of Worcester and Gloucester, John Hooper. Each of them was burned in the district in which he had first officiated. Hooper, like the other condemned martyrs, had denied papal supremacy over the church and the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. I don't know what that is. Let me search it up, guys. What's the Eucharist? There's a church called it in Hamilton. Oh, it's the Holy Communion. It's the communion. I love the communion, but it's different in Catholic. Basically, the Catholics believe that when you eat the bread and the wine or whatever, I don't think they have actual bread. They have, like, the communion cracker things, that it's, like, actually Jesus's body for that second. We just eat the bread. But I don't eat it because I'm allergic.
Dang.
Yeah, I don't understand why my church can't buy freaking nut-free bread. How hard is that? Like, actually, how hard is it to get nut-free bread, my guys?
Very easy, actually.
I could bring my own, but no. I just got really jealous of my minister when I was little because everyone else gets, like, a shot glass of grape juice. And he would get, like, an actual, like, goblet. And I always wanted this goblet of grape juice. Yeah. This John Hooper guy, though, he's like, no, when you eat the bread, it's not Jesus. It's just bread. Yeah. He was imprisoned in the Fleet on, that's, like, the big prison, the Fleet, on September 1st, 1553, and he remained there for more than 17 months. At the end of January 1555, he was brought before Stephen Gardiner and a number of other bishops, and he was pleaded with to give up his evil and corrupt doctrine and to conform to the Catholic Church. They were like, if you recant, Mary won't kill you. And he was like, no. And on February 9th, he was burned. Yeah, it was, like, really bad because it took 45 minutes to kill him.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't know why it took him so long, but it took him a long time to die. It was a horrific death, obviously, and this sight was going to be repeated nearly 300 times during Mary's reign. 300 times is not that many times, but it's still a lot of times.
In the grand scheme of things of all of the other...
Oh, yeah. Henry VIII killed 57,000 people, estimated. That's a lot, Henry. Mm-hmm. That's a no-no. Elizabeth also burned people and killed people. Just, you know, not, like, as crazy. Wait, let me search up how many people Elizabeth killed. So, guys. Oh, my God. It's trying to ask me how pregnant am I. I'm not pregnant. How many people? The Hot Cross Bun song is in my recommended because I was trying to figure out how old it was.
Love that for you.
For Broken Return.
Right. Yeah.
How many people? I feel like that's wrong.
What? What is it?
It says only 287 people. That's definitely wrong, but it says her short reign, so that's definitely not wrong. Definitely not right. Executions under Mary versus executions under Henry VIII. The seven bloodiest queens in history. Is Elizabeth on here? Oh my God. She is. Oh my God. Literally. Okay. So 450 people were executed after an uprising in the north by Elizabeth. During her reign, around 130 priests were executed for being priests, along with around 60 of their supporters. Although she didn't, by any accounts, take pleasure in executions, she also signed the death warrant for Mary, Queen of Scots. Yeah. Basically, she just, like, killed some people. Yeah. But it's fine. She did more good for the country than people. But that's great. In early 1555... the Privy Council sent something to Sir Nicholas Hare, Master of the Rolls, and other justices of the peace in the county of Middlesex for the execution of William Flower. They're like, yeah, sorry, guys. His offense is so bad that we need to cut off his hand before he gets executed.
Oh.
Because what he did was he hit a priest with a wooden knife in St. Margaret's Church, Westminster. I don't know why he'd use a wooden knife. That seems really dumb. Use a real knife. Like, what good is a wooden knife going to do? What's the point?
No clue.
He was burned on April 24th, 1555, just as the council's letter had asked. Most of the burnings in the summer were in London and Essex, in the diocese. So I guess it's like the people that go to this guy's church. Edmund Bonner, Bishop of London, who soon became synonymous with the persecution. Orders were sent to find anyone guilty of heresy and to report them to the authorities. Towns and villages were searched to find those who held heretical opinions and refused to observe the Catholic faith. Many of the victims were agricultural laborers and artisans denounced by their neighbors or their families, and they were victims of private grievances or local disputes. This sounds like the Salem witch trials.
It does.
When people were just like, no, it was her. I don't like her, so she was mean to me. She's a witch. She's a witch! Speaking of women, Margaret Poley, a woman living near Pembury, in Pembury near Tonbridge, was the first woman to be burned in Mary's reign. I mean, good job? Gender equity? Don't know. She had maintained that there was no reference to the Roman Catholic Church in the Bible and denied the real presence in the Mass. She was burned on July 18, 1555, along with two other martyrs in a gravel pit just outside Dartford in Kent. The local farmers brought cartloads of cherries to sell to the spectators. Other women followed. They gotta make money. So they're bringing cherries to burnings. It seems a little much, but, you know, we already know that people bring things to executions. It's the exact same thing. People are getting killed. Alice Bendon of Staplehurst in Kent was reported to the authorities by her own husband. That's not very nice. She was also disowned by her father. She had refused to attend church because she said that too much idolatry was practiced there. For 9 weeks, she was in the bishop's prison, living only on bread and water, and they didn't give her a change of clothes. It's not very nice. When offered the chance of freedom, if she recanted, she declared that she was thoroughly persuaded by the extremity that you have already shown me that you are not of God, neither can your doings be godly. She's like, you treat me like crap. So you guys are not God's representatives because God wouldn't do that. So shut up. And so she got burned in June 1557. But, like, good clap back. On the island of Guernsey, a woman named Catherine Couchin lived with her two daughters, Peritine Massey and Guillemine Gilbert. She is not subscribing to the five normal names that we know of. Peritine and Guillemine.
Dang.
Those sound like medicines. Maybe they are. Peritine had informed the authorities that a local woman, Vincent Gossett, had stolen a golden goblet. In revenge, Gossett said that Couchin and her two daughters were heretics. That seems nice. Literally, Peritine said that that Vincent stole the goblet, and Vincent was like, oh, your mom and your sister and you are all heretics. But they all got convicted because, you know, they were sentenced to death by burning, but Peritine hadn't told the authorities that she was pregnant. When they lit the sticks that are called the F slur, but I'm not going to use the F slur, the fire caused her to give birth to her baby son, who fell onto the burning sticks. Mm. One of the spectators rushed forward to save the baby and pulled him out of the fire, but the local sheriff, literally the worst man ever, who are you, ordered that the baby was thrown back in. He was burned. Yeah, he was burned with his mother, his grandmother, and his aunt altogether.
Why?
I don't know, because they don't execute women if they're pregnant, but why didn't you tell the authorities you're pregnant, Peritine? Seriously, what the heck? And why doesn't the baby get to live? Because babies are always innocent.
Like, they literally didn't do anything.
The baby was just born. Birth is already traumatic enough. So, literally, screw that sheriff. I hate you, man. I know you're man, because women can't be sheriffs, because it's 1557. So, screw you. Neither Mary or Pole had expected to burn so many people. They wanted the heretics to be reconciled rather than die, and for the burnings to be carried out, like, fairly, like, you know, according to the judges sort of thing. Like, according to the law, and without vindictiveness. So she didn't think that people were just going to, like, start accusing their neighbors because they were mad at them.
Yeah.
She thought that it was going to be fair. Mary ordered that a counselor was present to supervise each burning in London, and that during each execution they preached sermons. I feel like if I was dying for being a Protestant, I wouldn't want to hear Catholic sermons during my death. But
yeah, like
what's I that? Think she's trying to be nice. I don't know though. However, they felt that heresy was the worst of sins and needed to be killed or whatever in case it infected more people. But rather than extinguishing Protestant sentiment, as was Mary's intent, the burning served only to define more clearly the Protestants as a dissident group. So basically what she thought was going to happen was that she was going to have to burn, like, I don't know, like, maybe, like, 30 people that were, like, the big people that were in charge. And then people would be like, oh, okay, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to, like, I see the error of my ways. I'll recant. But they didn't do that. It kind of, backfired. Yeah. What if I tried something new and it backfired? It really backfired. Also, yeah. The courage of the people that died stirred the admiration of a lot of people that watched them die. Yeah. There was a lot of murmuring about the cruel enforcement of the recent acts of Parliament on heresy. Renard told Philip after the first London burnings that he didn't think that Philip should allow further executions to take place unless the reasons are overwhelmingly strong and the offenses committed have been so scandalous as to render the course justifiable in the eyes of the people. Well, they didn't stop. Increasingly, Protestantism was also associated with resistance to Spanish domination and the defense of English liberty. Philip was held responsible for many of the burnings. Sorry, Philip. Sorry, my dude. However, just days after John Roger's execution, Alfonso de Castro, Philip's confessor, preached a sermon at court with the king's sanction, attacking the burnings and saying that they shouldn't burn people, but they should just let people live and then be converted. So Philip didn't play the direct role that many of the people gave to him, but he also didn't do anything to forestall the persecution, and the burnings continued. Being a bystander is bad, guys.
Yeah, don't be bystanders.
Don't be a bystander. But to Mary, to halt the process would have been to condone heresy, and this she could never do. It was a affront to her conscience that had been forged in the years before she became queen. As the Venetian ambassador, Giovanni Soranzo, observed during her brother's reign, Mary had not conformed to the new religious service, her belief into that which she was born being so strong that had the opportunity offered, she would have displayed it at the stake. Honestly, yeah, Mary probably would have done that.
Honestly, she would have.
She would have. She would not have recanted. I don't think she knows what that word means in the opposite way. Yeah. On August 27th, Mary and Philip rode from Hampton Court through London to Greenwich, accompanied by the Lord Mayor and the Aldermen, the English and Spanish nobility, and Cardinal Pole. Mary had planned to travel by barge and for Philip to ride through the city, but at the last moment, she was like, "Now I'll come with you." So the streets were full of people, and they're really happy to see the King and Queen together, but also because they all thought she died, that she was not dead. There's a lot of rumors, remember, during her pregnancy, right, that something had happened to her. So they're like, oh my god, thank god she's not dead. 2 days later, Philip departed by river to commence his journey to Dover and then to Flanders. Yeah. It was for Mary a sad parting, but he probably wasn't as that sad. Or we know he wasn't as sad as her.
Yeah.
Philip and his retinue stayed at Canterbury for several days, waiting for good weather and the arrival of Flemish ships at Dover. Men were out on the road nearly every hour, carrying messengers and letters between the king and queen, and the messengers waited about the courtyard of Greenwich Palace night and day, ready to go. As Michielli reported, the queen wasn't content with having sent two of her chief chamberlains in the king's company for the purpose of being acquainted with everything that happens. She writes to him every single day in her own hand, and she sends courtiers to demonstrate her great desire. But Philip wrote less and less. So she's writing him like every day, and he's not. When Michielli had an audience with the queen on September 13th, Grace, it's your birthday.
It is my birthday.
She told him, crying, that for a week she hadn't had any letters from Philip. So maybe you shouldn't be very happy about that day being your birthday.
Oh.
She's really sad. So.
Yeah.
That sure sucks. Elizabeth just had her birthday too. September 7th. So. I bet she got to do nothing.
Yeah, probably.
2 weeks after the king's departure, Simon Renard left England. With Philip's arrival, his, really too close relationship with the queen had ended. He had asked to be recalled, but Charles refused, and he was like, no, you got to stay in England because you know everything that's happened since you've lived here for so long. So you got to give that benefit to Philip. But then Philip left, so he was like, yeah, Renard, you can come back. Since Elizabeth had arrived at court for Mary's confinement in late spring, she had remained with her until the autumn. By September, the French ambassador observed that Elizabeth was more in favor than she used to be. She went to mass every single day with Mary, and she was often, like, in her company. In mid-October, she obtained leave to withdraw, and she left the court back for Hatfield. At the same time, Philip's household servants, soldiers, and pages also began to withdraw. And most people thought that they were going to come back for a very long time. So, that's fun. Philip wanted to stay in touch with English affairs, and he had a body of advisors, a council of state that he established on his departure. The counselors lived at court, and they had to write to Philip 3 times a week. Important statutes and proclamations continued to be sent to the king for his signature, but as he turned his attention to the Netherlands, his correspondence became less frequent. So, great. In October 1555, Charles resigned the lordship of the Netherlands to Philip, and in January 1556, the crowns of Aragon and Castile. Philip now wanted power in England in his own right, not simply as a regent for the heir. He began to put pressure on Mary that she crown him, and even was suggesting that this would be a condition of his return to England. So he's like, I won't come back unless you crown me king.
Dang.
Yeah. Yet Mary was a little worried about that. Parliament was full of opposition, and she told Bedoer, I don't know who he is, I think he might be an ambassador, that she knew it to be impossible to form either of these important resolutions without greatly endangering her crown, but she hoped that in the course of a short time to comfort the king with what he seems to desire. Rumors were circulating of Philip's adventures abroad with, you know, he's having some adventures that are maybe R-rated. Great job, Philip. And Mary began to lose hope of him coming back. She told her ladies that she had done all possible to induce her husband to return, and as she found he would not, she meant to withdraw utterly from men and live quietly as she had done the chief part of her life before she married. So, thanks a lot, Philip, for being annoying. On the morning of March 21st, 1556, Thomas Cranmer, the 66-year-old former Archbishop of Canterbury, was burned alive in the town ditch in Oxford. That's just really sad for me. He was supposed to protect Elizabeth. He has not been doing that since he's been in prison, since Mary became queen. Thanks a lot. Cranmer was the highest profile person of the Marian martyrs, and one that Mary had always been determined to condemn as a heretic. It was he who had encouraged her father's break with Rome. He who had, as Archbishop of Canterbury, declared Catherine of Aragon's marriage invalid, and he who had performed the wedding of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. Upon Mary's accession, he had been condemned with Lady Jane Grey and three of Northumberland's sons for high treason for his support of Jane's succession, but his sentence had not been carried out. Mary bore him a very deep grudge, in case you couldn't tell. And even though he did recant, and the church law said that as a repentant heretic, he should be pardoned, she was determined that he burn. And she also wanted his death to be for heresy, not for other offenses. No. Given his status as Archbishop of Canterbury, she had had to wait for the restoration of papal jurisdiction. For 2.5 years, he had stayed in prison, just waiting to die, as you do. On the morning of Saturday, March 21st, 1556, it was kind of rainy. So given the weather, the sermon that was normally delivered before the burning at the stake was preached in St. Mary's Church. Cranmer was expected to deliver his 7th recantation. So they made him recant all these different things. There's a bunch of them, but I didn't feel that we needed to hear all of them because it was like 7 pages of explanation. And what he was supposed to do was retract his rejection of in the Holy Communion, the fact that Christ was there. So he had said, no, he's not. And they wanted him to recant that. So, yeah. Dr. Henry Cole, the provost of Eton, first preached the sermon explaining the reasons for Cranmer's execution. Seems a little weird that you have a whole sermon about why this guy should die, but who am I to judge? then, standing on a raised platform in a packed church, he didn't do what he was supposed to do.
Oh, God.
He said, "As for the Pope, I refuse him as Christ's enemy and Antichrist with all his false doctrine."
Oh.
Bestie. Okay. Whatever. He's 66. He was in prison. He was probably going to die soon anyways. I bet he'd probably get sick. The church descended into noise and protest. Cranmer was pulled from the stage and dragged through the streets to take the to the place of execution, where Ridley and Latimer had been burned, and fastened to the stake with an iron. He held his hand in the flames, and he cried out, "Unworthy right hand," because it was the hand that had signed the recantations, and then he died. So, yeah. What had been intended to be a great coup, the public recantation of the architect of the English Reformation, had been ruined. So it's supposed to be, like, a big PR move, because, you know, Cranmer, who literally, like, made the Church of England, was like, no, but he didn't. So, like, pop off, my dude. Way to ruin their day. Like, honestly, good job. The government immediately set out limiting the damage. The following day, Passion Sunday, Dr. Cole preached a denunciation of Cranmer in the same church that he had spoken in the day before. Within days, John Cowood printed all the submissions and recantations of Thomas Cranmer, which ended with Cranmer's final expected recantation rather than the one he'd actually delivered, so they put it that, like, he had done it. But he didn't. Yeah. On March 5th, 1566, there had been a blazing comet that appeared in the sky over London, and it shone for a whole week, and the Londoners were like, "What the heck? What is that?" But now people are going to be treasonous again. Yay! What was initially thought to be civil unrest in London would reveal itself to be much more, a plot to overthrow Mary. Oh, God. It was born of political disaffection and Protestant intrigue, and it sought to exploit the popular discontent that had been growing since the summer before. There had been massive rain and floods that had led to poor harvest and famine. Mary's pregnancy had been unsuccessful. Eek. The peace conference at Lamarck had failed, and the religious persecution continued. So the people were not happy.
No.
The death of the Lord Chancellor Stephen Gardiner on November 12th made Mary's task even harder. His health had been failing since the spring, and he had had a hard time speaking at the opening of Parliament. Without her primary supporters, she was left to face the Commons alone. So, yeah. Her determination to restore the Crown lands was matched by the Commons' reluctance to let them go for fear that they would have to give up what they had gained. By the new year, the discontent had gotten deeper. In January, the pace of religious persecution was getting faster, and the council decreed that the Queen's pardon should no longer be offered to heretics at the stake because of the contempt with which the offer was usually treated. So they'd be like, the Queen pardons you or whatever, and I guess the people that were getting burned would be like, screw you. So,
I guess, yeah.
Didn't work out. They also ordered that the people in the crowds at the burnings who were understood to be comforting, aiding, or praising the offenders would be imprisoned. So, great.
Yeah.
The rebellion was led by Sir Henry Dudley, a cousin of the late Duke of Northumberland. What the actual heck? It's literally the exact same family that's done this every single time. I can't. The conspiracy wanted to break the Spanish alliance and replace Mary with Elizabeth. Did we have to drag Elizabeth into this again? Seriously.
No.
After setting fire to several areas of the city to disguise their purpose, the plotters planned to rob the exchequer of £50,000 in silver bullion and flee to the Isle of Wight in two of the Queen's ships, which were already, like, ready. There, they would raise forces and start a national rebellion where Dudley sailed from France with a number of other exiles. But it didn't happen. Because before the plan could be executed, Thomas White, an exchequer official, leaked the plot to Cardinal Pole. At first, the council waited, giving the conspirators time to begin executing the plot, while secretly moving money out of the exchequer. Finally, on March 18th, it acted. The chief conspirators were arrested and sent to the Tower, so that's great. Then lengthy inquiries followed throughout March and April as the web of conspiracy became even wider, revealing links to exchequer officials, fugitives in France, and gentry and officials across the country, including Sir Anthony Kingston, Sir William Courtenay, Sir John Pollard, and Richard Overdale, who was captain of the Isle of Wight. On April 4th, Dudley and most of his fellow conspirators were declared traitors. Yeah, but Dudley stayed in France, so he didn't get arrested. Smart. Yeah. Good job. 2 weeks later, the rebel John, the Frog, were hanged and quartered at Tyburn. Kingston died on his way to London, and eventually 10 men were executed. R.I.P., I guess, like, I don't know. I don't really feel that bad when people got killed for trying to overthrow the government, because that's just how it worked then. Like, you knew that either you were going to do it or you're going to die. So, just saying. We were talking about that in American history class, so you can all chill. The plot had thrown the popular discontent of the people and the willingness of France to intervene against Mary into sharp... everyone was like, okay. All of the plotters were heretics. Many of them were associates of Sir Thomas Wyatt. Their common cause, as with Wyatt's rebellion 2 years before, was the unpopularity of the Spanish marriage, which had become even more unpopular because there was a new fear that Philip was going to be crowned King of England. By the summer, there was something of a siege mentality at court. Mary no longer appeared in public. She lived instead, like, by herself, the palace full of armed men, and the queen so afraid that she wouldn't sleep more than 3 hours a night. That doesn't sound healthy. Mary, no. God. In the middle of all this uncertainty, she was even more anxious for Philip to come back. In the middle of March, on the queen's instructions, the English ambassador asked Philip to, say frankly in how many days he was going to return. Mason gently suggested that the king would comfort the queen, as also the peers of the realm, by his presence, saying that there was no reason yet to despair of his babies, please. In April, Mary changed tack. She sent Lord Paget as her envoy. But, you know, it's just not, he's not, he doesn't want to come back because he wants to get crowned.
Yeah.
Mary now spent her time in tears, regrets, and writing letters to bring back her husband. She kept switching between a sense of anger and a sense of abandonment. Increasingly, she became mad at Philip, and she was reported to be scratching portraits of her husband, which she kept in her room. Because, like, she doesn't have pictures, so she can't, like, rip them up or whatever, or, like, listen to sad music and cry. So she just scratches portraits of him. Finally, right. She wrote to the emperor again, and she was like, "Excuse me, Uncle Charles. Can you please send back my husband, who is also my cousin?"
Ew.
Well, yeah. And she's like, "It's for the safety of my kingdom." Okay. On May 26th, more than 2 months after the collapse of Dudley's conspiracy, they gotta go to Elizabeth. Two of Mary's most trusted servants were sent to Elizabeth at Hatfield with a posse of troops. An armed guard was put around her house, and her lady mistress, Catherine Ashley, her Italian teacher, Giovanni Bastida Castiglione, and three other women of her household were arrested and taken to London. A search of Cat's chambers at Somerset House had found incriminating anti-Catholic and anti-Spanish literature. Cat. That's what Catherine Ashley was called by Elizabeth. Because Kat was basically her mother because, you know.
Yeah.
The advice that Mary received was heavily influenced by Habsburg interest. Although there was evidence that Elizabeth had been involved in treasonous activity. What? Basically, they're like, we can't go against Elizabeth because if Elizabeth isn't the heir, then the English throne goes to Mary, Queen of Scots, and Mary, Queen of Scots, was betrothed to the Dauphin of France. So if Philip wanted to triumph over the Valois in the struggle between their two houses, this was something that he had to prevent. I mean, good thing that they did that, because if we didn't have Elizabeth the First, who knows where we'd be?
No.
Hastings and Englefield were sent to Elizabeth to inform her of her servant's confessions, but also to assure her that Mary trusted in her innocence. The armed guard was stood down, and Elizabeth was given a diamond ring as a gesture of the Queen's goodwill. But unable to, you know, totally trust Elizabeth, Mary ordered that she be placed in the guardianship of Sir Thomas Pope, a loyal privy councillor and a Catholic, who was put in charge of her household. So, yay. During the autumn of 1556, relations between the two sisters seemed to continue to get better. Elizabeth was freed from Pope's supervision, and she was invited to spend Christmas at court. Yay! She left Hatfield escorted by 200 livery gentlemen on horseback, and on November 28th, among cheering crowds, entered the city of London. 3 days later, she was received by the Queen, With like Honor and Amica Valley, everyone's like, yay! But then suddenly, without any warning, the invitation for Christmas was withdrawn, and on December 3rd, she had to go back to Hatfield. It's not even Christmas yet. God. Philip's support of Elizabeth had come at a price. With a very small prospect of an heir to the English throne actually being born of Mary, he had looked to secure a marriage for Elizabeth that would preserve his interest in England and the Catholic Restoration. The intended bridegroom was, oh God, Emmanuel Philibert, the Prince of Piedmont and the titular Duke of Savoy. Can you imagine being married to someone named Emmanuel Philibert?
No.
I think that I would have to go with Elizabeth's route on that and say no thank you. The 28-year-old Duke was Philip's cousin. He was a loyalist imperialist and had also committed Catholic, obviously. He had come to England in December 1554 as the recognized candidate for Elizabeth's hand. But Elizabeth was like, no. By the winter of 1556, the idea had been revived, and Philip pressured Mary to force Elizabeth to submit to his will. Mary threatened Elizabeth with a parliamentary declaration of Elizabeth being a bastard and an acknowledgement of Mary, Queen of Scots, as her heir if she wouldn't comply. Elizabeth was like, no, I'm still not doing that. And Mary sent her sister away from court. I feel like everybody already knows that Elizabeth is a bastard if Mary's legitimate. Like,
yeah. Isn't that
she's like, no, I'm going to make it official.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever actually said anything about it. I think they just kind of let it be. At 5 in the afternoon of March 20th, 1557, Philip finally came back. Yay! A 32-gun salute greeted him at Greenwich. Everyone's like, yay! Woohoo! God save you, your majesty. The following day, the bells of London rang out in celebration. There was a bunch of entertainments, and they all just kind of, like, rode through London, all the, like, important people. One diplomat described it as a warmed-over honeymoon, yet despite the festivities, there was little disguising the true purpose of Philip's visit. The king had returned for money and an English declaration of war against France, which was a prospect that very few Englishmen were happy with. Because, you know, they don't want to go to war. No thanks.
No.
When Philip returned to England in late March, both he and the queen were like, hey, council, declare war. Yeah, but the counselors were like, sorry, we can't do that. They said that they would approve financial and naval support to Philip, but they wouldn't promise any troops or declare openly against France. They maintained that the realm wasn't in any condition to wage war. They're like, we don't have any money, we don't have any food, and our people are mad at us. We're not going to declare war. So, yeah, Mary's really mad at them. She's pissed.
Yeah.
Not happy. Yeah. She ordered the counselors that they had to meet again and draft a reply that would satisfy her and her husband. The council remained defiant, but Mary was determined to fulfill Philip's demands. On April 13th, before the court went to Greenwich for Easter, she summoned the counselors privately to her room and threatened each of them, some with death, others with the loss of their goods and estate. So I guess, you know, she picked the ones she didn't like to threaten with death, if they didn't consent to the will of her husband. So now the council's like, fine, we will give you money and troops. But Philip was like, I'm not going to be satisfied with anything other than an open declaration of war. Ugh, gross, Philip. You're so annoying. On April 23rd, 1557, Sir Thomas Stafford, an English Protestant exile, landed on the Yorkshire coast at Scarborough with two French ships and a force of up to 100 English and French rebels and seize Scarborough Castle. His aim was to depose Mary, you know, because she's mad at her for marrying Philip. God. Aww. These people are so annoying. But the government reacted quickly, and within 5 days, the Earl of Westmoreland had taken the castle, and on April 30th, a proclamation was issued in London announcing Stafford's capture. He was tried, condemned, and executed for treason at Tyburn a month later. But the rebellion proved the catalyst for the declaration of war with France, because French people helped him try to depose Mary. So,
yeah.
This is the second time that they've done that. Within weeks of England entering into the war, Philip left England. So now we all know what he really wanted.
Yeah.
Mary accompanied him to Dover, and then he set sail from there, and at 3 a.m. on July 6th, the king and queen parted company at the quayside, and they would never see each other ever again.
Oh.
Yeah. On New Year's Day, 1558. God, we're already in 1558, y'all. It's the end. 27,000 French troops attacked Calais. On the 3rd, Thomas, Lord Wentworth, who was now the Lord Deputy of Calais, wrote to Philip and was like, yeah, it's not going well. The garrison was ill-prepared. It was undermanned. French forces led by Francis, the Duke of Guise, had been able to take them by surprise by launching their attack in midwinter. The garrisons of Guisans and Hounds held out until January 21st when forces under William Lord Grey, short of ammunition and food, also surrendered. Just a few months after the victory at St. Quentin, the French had inflicted a catastrophic defeat on the English. So this is not good. This is like Mary's only military thing that she ever did. So,
yeah,
that's part of the reason that she's not remembered very well. Especially because Elizabeth had her whole Spanish Armada thing, you know?
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. But yeah, so basically, things are not happening well. The recriminations began almost immediately. Lord Wentworth, people claimed, was a heretic and had intrigued with others within and outside of Calais. Many Englishmen believed that Philip had done less than he could to assist the garrison, while the Spanish argued that the fortress had been lost through English incompetence. As the last remnant of the English claimed the continental monarchy, Calais had a very symbolic value. So basically, Calais belongs to the English people. It's still theirs. It's left over from, oh my god, 100 Years' War, I believe. It's the only thing that they had left. And so it's really important. It's part of the reason that they call themselves kings of, like, God. It's just, it's a big deal. Also, Elizabeth was conceived there, so now they've lost that, too.
Yeah,
she can't go visit her place of being conceived. She probably still could, but like, I feel like I'd be annoyed if I was like, you took this from us. But it was like a really symbolic value, so it was really important to the British people. It's kind of like, oh my god, I don't know, like Alaska. Like if we took Alaska from the Americans, I don't really think Alaska does like anything for them. Sorry if we have people from Alaska that are listed, but I don't really know what you guys do, and I don't think there's that many of you that live there. So like the Americans would be bad. But yeah, Calais had been captured by Edward III in 1347 and was the last remnant of the Anglo-French Empire that had stayed, all the way from the Normans, who are the conquerors, William the Conqueror was a Norman in 1066, to the Wars of the Roses. So, not the best that Mary lost it. Good job. Yeah. Good job, Mary. Really proud of you. It's okay. It's not like she was on the field, but like, yeah, so people are mad at her. The conclusion of peace between Philip and the Pope on September 12th, 1557, was greeted with great jubilation in London. It's just like really annoying. People are so blah, 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 blah. But yeah, Cardinal Pole is like in trouble. He like basically becomes like kind of heretic sort of thing, but like not. Just 4 years before, Mary had described herself as the Pope's most obedient and affectionate daughter. She said that His Holiness had no more loving daughter than herself. Now, as the last months of her life drew near, her relations with the Pope became significantly strained. It was a massive irony that upon Mary's death, the Pope would initially express gratification upon the accession of Elizabeth as an improvement on her sister. He was like, yeah, this is better for us. I don't think it was, my dear friend, the Pope, since you excommunicated Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, now Mary thinks she's pregnant again. Yeah. This time, she waited until what she believed was her 6th month, and then in January 1558, she sent word to Philip. By May, Mary's health had deteriorated. She suffered from intermittent fevers, insomnia, headaches, and loss of vision. She already had really bad eyes. Like, they were very, very bad. Like, no. It was clear that there was no pregnancy. Writing to Philip, Feria described that she slept badly, she was weak, and she suffered from melancholy. Melancholy is what they called depression before they had a word for it.
Yeah.
Because it just means sad. And her indisposition results in business being handled more slowly than it should be. Over the summer, she grew even more weak. In August, she caught the flu. Then she caught an endemic in the country, and she was moved from Hampton Court to St. James's Palace. forced to acknowledge the seriousness of her condition. She added something to her will that she was like, yeah, I'm not feeling that great, so it's unlikely that I'm with child. Because before, when she thought she was pregnant, like, you know, a few months ago, she added a clause to, like, she added onto her will, and it was like, everything goes to my child.
Yeah.
Because she's like, my child's my heir, so, like, you know, Elizabeth is not mentioned. And then she was like, in this one, she says, if God doesn't grant her an heir, then she would be succeeded by her next heir and successor by the laws and statutes of the realm. But she didn't ever actually acknowledge Elizabeth by name.
Dang. She's mad.
She just isn't down for Elizabeth at the moment. By the terms of the marriage treaty, Philip's, you know, power in England would cease with Mary's death. In April, the marriage between Mary, Queen of Scots, and the French Dauphin, the first future Francis II, had finally taken place. This isn't going to be that great for Mary, Queen of Scots, because Francis is going to die, like, really, really quickly. But, yeah. If Mary Stuart's claim to the English throne could be secured, France's position would be strengthened immeasurably and tipped the balance in the Habsburg-Valois struggle. Even if Elizabeth succeeded, Philip feared that her Protestant sympathies would lead to a diplomatic realignment, like with France or something, that would... Eek. Ferrer was instructed to visit Elizabeth on the king's behalf, present his compliments, express Philip's hope that, like, they'd still be friends when Elizabeth became queen, and, like, you know, get to know the men that were around her. Elizabeth was like, yeah, sure, whatever. I'll always be nice to you, because when I was in prison, you showed me favor, and you helped to get me out. But she dismissed the suggestion that she might marry a Spanish dude. She's like, no, sorry, that's not happening. But yeah, definitely, I'll be nice to you. Let's remind ourselves that she defeated him in the Spanish Armada.
Yes.
Yeah. The first few days of November saw Mary's condition kind of get better. And as the Parliament met, the council petitioned her to make certain declarations in the favor of the Lady Elizabeth concerning the succession. On November 6th, Mary was like, fine, I consent. Elizabeth is my heir. It was what she had fought to avoid for most of her life, but now she knew that she was going to die soon, so she realized that she didn't really have any choice. Sir Thomas Cornwallis, the comptroller of the royal household, and John Boxall, the secretary to the Privy Council, were sent to Hatfield to give Elizabeth the news. Mary asked that Elizabeth pay her debts and keep the Catholic religion in England just as it had been established. Elizabeth was like, yes, I will definitely keep Catholics here. But Mary knew that it wasn't really, you know, real. Yeah. It was just a nice little promise, since she was dying, for Elizabeth to be like, yep, definitely, we'll do. Her hands were crossed behind her back, though. Yeah. She was lying. Just before midnight on Wednesday, November 16th, Mary received the last rites. Oh, it's 1557. Mary received the last rites in her chamber at St. James's Palace. A few hours later, between 5 and 6 in the morning, she died. She was 42. Not very old. In his Acts and Monuments of these Latter and Perilous Days, John Fox, the most infamous returning exile after Elizabeth came to the throne, celebrated the passing of Mary's reign. He's like, oh my god, this is a trash time. Yeah, he's interesting. His detailed account of the lives of the Protestant martyrs graphically portrayed the horrible and bloody time of Queen Mary. Coinciding with the rise of the Accession Day festivities for Elizabeth, was an order that a copy of Fox's Acts and Monuments be installed in every church. By 1600, Catholicism was firmly understood to be an un-English thing, and Protestantism part of England's national identity. Fox's account shaped the popular narrative of Mary's reign for the next 450 years. Generations of children would grow up knowing the first Queen of England only as Bloody Mary, a Catholic tyrant who sent nearly 300 Protestants to their deaths, a point made satirically in W.C. Seller and R.J. Yeatman's 1930s parody 1066 and All That. Recently, Mary was in a recent survey of the most evil men and women in history, and this is testament to Fox's enduring legacy. Thanks, Fox. God. Yeah. But, you know, there is, of course, a different Mary, a woman who is marked by suffering, devout in her faith, and very courageous. From a childhood in which she was adored and petted over and then violently rejected, a fighter was born. Her resolve almost cost her life because, you know, her dad was like, I'm gonna kill you if you don't do what I want. And then her brother was mad at her too. But she still kept her faith and her self-belief. Despite her repeated attempts to deprive her of her right to the throne, she became The warrior queen. Yay. The boldness and the scale of her achievement are often overlooked because the campaign that Mary led in the summer of 1553 over Lady Jane Grey to become queen was actually the only successful revolt against the central government in 16th century England. So good job. She, like her grandfather Henry VII and her grandmother, Isabel of Castile, had had to fight for her throne. In her moment of crisis, she had proved decisive, courageous, and had won the support of the English people as a legitimate Tudor heir. So basically, now we're done with her, but now we got to talk about if we think she's bloody or not. Grace, what do you think?
No. I wrote a whole thing in history about it.
Yes, you did. I think it's called trauma makes people do things.
I think it's sexist.
It is sexist. We already know this. It's obviously sexist. Yeah, so we've got, how many people did Elizabeth the First execute? I don't know. It's so annoying because, like, people that win get to write history. So Elizabeth won, and so the people that support her get to write history, and because they were rivals, then Mary gets to get the shaft. Oh my god. Okay, I'm literally on a website right now that is talking about executions under Mary versus executions under Henry. First of all, here's a painting of Anne Boleyn getting executed.
Oh.
No thanks. She looks really nice, but she's dying. She didn't kill any more people than Henry VIII or Elizabeth I. Wait, I don't have, like, a calculator. Let's see. Let me go to a calculator. So she killed, like, almost 300 people. You know, give or take. Over, like, how many years was she queen, Grace? You do the math right now. I'm really tired.
Wait, when? What? How? Where? What am I doing? Tell me.
Do math. Okay, 300. I'm doing it. Okay, 1553 to 1557 is 4 years. 300 divided by 4 is 75. So, 75 people per year. Then, we've got our dear friend Henry VIII. This is 57,000. 1, 2, 3 zeros. Divided by, God, 1509 to 1547 is 38 years. Right?
Yeah.
No. God, yes, it is. It is 38 years. 1,500. He killed an average of 1,500 people every year.
And what was Mary's average?
75.
Like 75 or 7,500?
75 people.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's our answer, folks.
Yeah, it's called sexism. I mean, Henry VIII does not have a good legacy. Let us be honest.
Yeah, but still. He's not known as, like, death-provoking Henry. Like, no one calls him that.
Yeah, so Henry executed Catholics, he executed Lutherans. All of this, here we go. This is what this says here, this person. All of this points to the fact that Henry executed a far greater number of people than Mary and had a wide variety of suspicious reasons for doing so. Mary executed people because she thought it was the duty given to her by God. Henry, on the other hand, was known to have a bad temper, and once he got on his bad side, he would not get off of it. He executed people if they did not agree with him or if they made his life more difficult.
Because he was like,
Yeah, and Elizabeth also killed people, but thanks, Elizabeth. So basically, y'all, Bloody Mary is not a nice name.
Don't call her that.
Let's call him Bloody Henry. Yuck. Okay. So, this is the end of our Mary Tudor part. So, this means that we have a week off in between before we start our next person. I'm pretty sure that Grizz probably knows who we're going to do since we've talked about it before.
Yeah.
And, y'all are hopefully going to like her since it's in the same time period and place. So, great job for me for being creative. That's what we're going to do. We're going to have a break, and then we will see you my next week when I'm in American history class, which is just great, which means that I don't have to research in English week, which is good because English week is like my death. It's so hard online. I hate it so much. You should go follow us on all of our social media accounts. You should follow us on our TikTok, which is Not So Bloody Mary _podcast. You should follow us on our Instagram, which is NotSoBloodyMary_podcast. We're very creative with names. You should go follow Grace on TikTok. It is TheLovely_bookworm. And you should go follow us on Twitter, which is Bloody_not, I believe, but I'm pretty sure you could also just search us up and you'd find us. You should go to iTunes and leave us a review and rate our podcast because it helps other people find us. And if you wanted, you could go to anchor.fm and search up Not So Bloody Mary and you can leave us a voicemail. So, yeah, that's what you should do. And Grace, what are they going to do in their lives today?
Go listen to Olivia Rodrigo's new song.
Yeah, that's what you're going to do. Grace is about to go do it, right? Yeah,
I am.
Yeah. And, like, literally, it's so good to dance to. I love it. Let's not call Mary the first Bloody Mary. That's your reminder for the day. Y'all are also going to become our, like, army. Whenever you hear anybody referring to her as that, you should, like, yell at them.
Yeah.
That is exactly what we do. So, yeah. Have a good rest of your day or night or evening or morning or whatever. Maybe you don't live by days. You just live. So, have a good rest of your whatever. We'll see you in 2 weeks. And, yeah. We love you all very much. Have a good time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.